Imagine a video game that, well, literally dreams itself into existence right as you're playing it.
Yeah, frame by frame.
Exactly. Or, think about a pair of everyday reading glasses that can project a massive 4K monitor directly onto your retina.
It sounds like sci-fi, but it's really not anymore.
Right. Or even a warehouse robot that learns how to do your job just by watching you do it once.
Just observing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because for decades, there's been this very clear, very physical boundary between us and the digital world. Like you exist on one side and all the data exists on the other, trapped behind this glowing rectangular sheet of glass.
Right. It's always been a binary relationship, a border wall,
Yeah.
essentially. But I mean, the structural integrity of that wall is completely failing right now.
And what happens when that glass just completely shatters and the digital world saturates our physical reality? Well, welcome to today's deep dive. This is custom tailored for you, the curious learner who really just wants to cut through the noise, skip all the dense jargon, and get straight to those underlying aha
Yeah,
moments.
we have a massive one today.
We really do. Today, we are dissecting this sweeping multi-industry dispatch called the Tempton Morning Report, the 2026 Technological Convergence.
And, convergence really is the perfect term for what this report is outlining. It details six major technological events that have either just leaked or officially launched.
Right.
And when you look at them individually, sure, they're impressive. But when you look at them together, they represent the exact moment where the line between the organic human being and the digital machine just dissolves.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the best place to start is, well, with the literal screens in front of our faces.
Great.
We're talking about the massive leak of Apple's Project Mirage, which looks like it's going to hit the market as the Apple Vision Air.
Finally.
Yeah, finally. But the spec that is absolutely dominating the tech forums today isn't the resolution. It's the weight. The headset weighs 50 grams.
Which is just a staggering drop when you consider the historical baseline.
I mean, the first generation Apple Vision Pro weighed something like, what, 600 to 650 grams?
Roughly.
Going from that to 50 grams, that is literally like going from strapping a heavy desktop computer and a motorcycle helmet to your face.
To sliding on a pair of sunglasses.
Right, just lightweight everyday sunglasses. But I am honestly trying to wrap my head around the physics of that. Because you still need massive processing power to run a mixed reality environment. How do they cut that much physical mass?
By realizing you don't actually need the heavy processing hardware sitting on the bridge of your nose.
Okay.
Apple has deployed this cybernetic strategy, and it's known as distributed processing. See, the reason older headsets were so incredibly heavy is that they housed, dense batteries, power-hungry GPUs.
And all those fans.
Exactly, all the aggressive copper thermal cooling you need to keep those chips from literally burning your skin.
Yeah.
But the Vision Air strips practically all of that away. It acts as an intelligent optical terminal.
Wait, so it's essentially just an empty shell? It just receives a video feed.
Well, not entirely empty, but highly, highly specialized. The glasses contain a custom NPU, a neural processing unit, called the R2. And unlike a general processor, an NPU is specifically designed to handle complex spatial math. So its only job is to track where your eyes are looking, where your hands are moving, and to map the 3D geometry of the room you're standing in.
Got it. So where does the actual graphics rendering happen?
That's the distributed part. The heavy graphical lifting rendering the high-definition windows and the avatars is outsourced wirelessly. It uses next-generation ultra-wideband, which is this high-speed, zero-lag radio protocol, to instantly bounce that heavy lifting to the M6 chip in the MacBook on your desk.
Or like the iPhone in your pocket.
Exactly, the device you're already carrying.
That makes total sense. You're using the battery and processor you already have. But if it's acting as a terminal, how does the display actually work if it's just clear glass?
So what's fascinating here is where the optical hardware fundamentally shifts. We're moving away from micro OLED and into holographic micro LED technology.
Okay, what's the difference?
Well, with the older, heavier headsets, you were basically looking at a tiny television screen trapped inside a dark box. The headset used cameras on the outside to record the world and then played that video feed back to your eyes.
Right, the pass-through, it was an opaque wall.
Exactly. But the Vision Air glasses are completely transparent. You are looking at the actual physical real world with your naked organic eye.
Wow.
The digital user interface is projected directly onto your retina using these nanometer scale laser projectors embedded right into the stems of the glasses.
Think about what that means for you, the listener, for a second. If you're listening to this on your commute or walking down the street, If your glasses have a 14-hour battery life thanks to a tiny magnetic pocket battery,
which they do,
and your GPS navigation arrows are painted onto the actual physical street in front of you, and your messages just float organically in your peripheral vision, why would you ever pull a 200-gram slab of glass and metal out of your pocket again?
You wouldn't.
The smartphone era as a physical interaction model is basically over.
It's a profound shift in how we consume digital information. But, you know, if the physical screens we look at are vanishing into thin, transparent glass, it introduces a really fascinating downstream effect.
Which is?
The way we actually build the digital worlds we're looking at is also changing completely.
Oh, right. Which naturally leads us to software, specifically the gaming and entertainment industry. Because OpenAI just unveiled Sora 3.0.
Yeah, this is huge.
Now, we've known Sora as a text video generator. You type a prompt, you get a short static video file. But the Tekken Report classifies Sora 3.0 as a real-time reality engine.
And the closed-door developer demo they conducted, well, it's going to fundamentally upend how interactive media is created.
Yeah, I read the raw data on this demo, and the speed of creation is just hard to fathom. A developer types a simple prompt, something like, a rainy cyberpunk city in Tokyo with flying cars fully explorable by the player. That is it. Just text. And 5 seconds later, the developer is dropped into a 4K resolution, 60 frames per second, fully interactive, playable environment. Not a single 3D polygon was meticulously modeled by a human artist.
No lighting maps manually baked in.
Right.
And, crucially, no underlying physics code was written to govern that world.
Okay, hold on. I need to push back on that a bit. Because I've messed around with basic game design before.
Sure.
If a player is holding a controller, right, and they walk up to a brick wall in this AI-generated city and hit it, how does the game know the wall is solid? If no programmer wrote a single line of collision physics, why doesn't the player just clip straight through the geometry?
That right there is the fundamental difference between classical computing and neural networks.
Mm-hmm.
In classical game design, developers use a discrete physics engine, something like Havok or Chaos.
Right, the standard tools.
Exactly. Those engines use strict mathematical formulas calculating mass, velocity, hitboxes to determine what happens when two objects collide. But Sora 3.0 completely discards mathematical physics engines. It runs on massive clusters of NVIDIA B200 GPUs, and the neural network visually understands the physical logic of the world based on its training.
Understands it how exactly?
Well, it has analyzed billions of hours of real-world video data, so it inherently recognizes the pattern that a solid human body cannot intersect with a solid brick wall.
Oh.
So when you push your joystick to walk into the wall, the AI doesn't run a collision calculation. It synthesizes the very next frame of the game based on probabilistic outputs. It anticipates what should happen next visually.
So it just...
It's literally hallucinating the physics of the world in real time, frame by frame, purely reacting to your input.
That is insane. So it's not a pre-rendered world. It is literally dreaming the video game into existence the exact moment you interact with it.
Exactly. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the economic ramifications of that mechanism are staggering. I mean, we are looking at a $400 billion global gaming industry.
Right.
Right now, a blockbuster game requires armies of 3D designers, animators, and programmers working for half a decade. But with a real-time reality engine, an indie developer with zero budget can conjure an expansive, hyper-realistic, fully interactive environment just by having a descriptive imagination.
But here is the paradox. If an AI can now generate a photorealistic interactive world in 5 seconds, the human body's physical reaction time is suddenly the absolute slowest part of the entire loop.
By far.
How do we even interact with a system that is generating realities that quickly? I mean, our thumbs on a plastic controller just aren't fast enough.
No, they're not. To keep pace with the convergence, we have to bypass the physical mechanics of the human body entirely.
Which brings us to what the Tekken Report calls the Apollo 11 moment of neuroscience, Neuralink. They just showcased a multiplayer gaming match that feels straight out of science fiction. Two quadriplegic patients, both equipped with the Neuralink N1 chip implanted in their motor cortexes, played a highly competitive fighting simulator similar to Street Fighter.
They used absolutely nothing but their minds.
Nothing. No mechanical keyboards, no handheld controllers, not a single muscle fiber moved.
And, I mean, the ability to play is wonderful in itself, but the underlying input latency metrics are what truly redefine human capability here.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Let's talk about the biological highway, because this is wild to me. Usually, if you're playing a fighting game and you decide you want to punch an opponent, your brain makes that decision.
Right.
And that electrical signal has to travel from your motor cortex all the way down your spinal cord, out through the nerve pathways in your arm, and finally trigger the physical muscles in your fingers to depress a plastic button.
The long trip.
It is. That entire biological commute takes roughly 150 to 200 milliseconds.
Which, in the realm of highly competitive gaming, a 200 millisecond delay is an eternity.
Exactly. But the Neuralink N1 chip uses 1,024 ultra-fine electrodes to read the brain's activity directly. So when the player mentally wills their character to throw a punch, the algorithm decodes that motor intention straight from the cortex and sends it wirelessly to the console.
Immediately.
The input command registers in under 10 milliseconds.
That's incredible.
Telepathic gaming isn't just a neat accessibility trick anymore. It is physically and mathematically faster than human reflexes on the world's most expensive mechanical keyboards.
And this raises an important question about the future, because it introduces an entirely new paradigm called neuro esports. We are looking at the horizon of competitive tournaments where physical dexterity, muscle memory, and age are completely irrelevant. Players would be ranked entirely on their neurological capacity, mental focus, and parallel processing speeds. Now, naturally, the medical and bioethics communities are rigorously debating the implications of this.
Right. What are the primary concerns they're raising?
It mostly centers on unprecedented neurological addiction.
Oh, interesting.
Think about it. If you wire a hyper-stimulating game engine directly into the cerebral cortex, the dopamine spikes from an instant victory or a fast-paced reward loop are delivered straight to the brain's reward centers.
With no physical fatigue to make you stop playing.
Exactly. There's no physical filter.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other side of that debate, the medical community acknowledges the undeniable reality for millions of individuals who have suffered severe spinal cord injuries or physical mobility loss.
Right. It's life-changing.
For them, a sub-10 millisecond neural interface is absolute freedom. It restores their ability to interact with digital environments and, by extension, the broader world on a completely level playing field.
It is a profound medical breakthrough, impartially speaking. But let's look at the infrastructure holding all of this up. Because if we are hallucinating real-time realities with Sora on one end, and we're decoding sub-10 millisecond neural inputs with Neuralink on the other, classical silicon computers are going to eventually hit a wall trying to process that sheer volume of data.
They absolutely will.
We need quantum computing to handle the convergence. But quantum computers are notoriously unstable, right? Like a slight temperature change and the whole calculation just collapses.
They are incredibly fragile, yes.
How do you stabilize a system like that while running something as demanding as a reality engine?
Well, you've highlighted the massive bottleneck in quantum computing, which is a phenomenon called decoherence. Quantum bits, or qubits, are highly sensitive to any environmental noise, thermal fluctuations, or even stray electromagnetic radiation.
So if a truck drives by outside?
Literally, yes. Mm-hmm. If the environment isn't perfectly controlled at near absolute zero, the quantum state collapses and you lose the calculation.
That sounds like a nightmare to manage.
It is. Historically, engineers tried to fix this using classical quantum error correction. That meant building thousands of physical qubits just to babysit and correct the errors of one single logical qubit. It was massively inefficient.
But the Tekken Report details a huge breakthrough from Google's DeepMind team regarding their Gemini quantum project. They managed to stabilize the system, but not by building bigger freezers.
A completely different approach.
They injected an ultra-lightweight version of the Gemini AI directly into the hardware controllers of their Sycamore quantum processors.
Right. So instead of a rigid classical algorithm trying to fix errors after they happen, the AI acts as an active supervisory agent.
It makes me think of a race car. The old method of quantum computing is like having a mechanic who only fixes the engine after it has already blown up on the track.
That's a great way to look at it.
But Google's new AI method is like having a clairvoyant mechanic physically riding inside the engine block. The AI constantly monitors the subatomic environment, predicts that a quantum state is about to destabilize, and adjusts the calibration a fraction of a nanosecond before the breakdown actually occurs.
That is precisely the mechanism. It is predictive stabilization rather than reactive repair. And the metrics prove just how effective it is.
Let's hear the numbers.
By shifting to this AI-driven error correction, Google dropped the logical to physical qubit ratio from 1 to 1,000 all the way down to 1 to 45.
Meaning you need vastly less physical hardware to get stable, usable quantum calculations.
Exactly. And they boosted the coherence time, which is the amount of time the quantum state remains stable enough to perform calculations, from roughly 100 microseconds to over 5 milliseconds.
Wow.
That is a 50x improvement. It essentially proves that the path to quantum supremacy isn't just about colder temperatures. It requires neural networks actively managing the physical hardware at a subatomic level.
And if AI is learning how to manage physical reality at a subatomic level, well, it was really only a matter of time before it stepped out of the server room and into our macroscopic blue-collar workspaces.
Which is happening faster than anyone predicted.
The report details a leaked B2B agreement between Amazon and Tesla. Amazon has officially started deploying the Tesla Optimus Gen 3 humanoid robots across three of its mega fulfillment centers in Texas. And the trial numbers are just wild. They have already replaced 30% of the human logistics workforce in those specific facilities.
The pace of that replacement is what is catching labor economists completely off guard.
And I have to admit, I was initially confused by this.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've had robots in warehouses for over a decade. You know, think of those little floor-roaming robots that carry entire shelves of products around.
The Kiva robots, yeah.
Right. So I didn't get why giving a robot arms and legs suddenly threatens a third of the workforce in a matter of months. What makes Optimus Gen 3 so different?
It comes down to the architecture of the robot's brain. Earlier warehouse robots, like those shelf carriers, required hard-coded line-by-line programming. You had to map the warehouse floor perfectly, put QR codes on the ground, and script exactly how the machine should pick up a specific, rigidly standardized box.
So a box was out of place, it would just break down.
It would error out, yeah. Optimus doesn't use rigid code. It uses an end-to-end neural network. Specifically, the FSD V13 architecture, which is the exact same foundation Tesla uses for its autonomous driving.
So it's not following a pre-written script of how to move.
Not at all. It utilizes a transformer-based brain. In simple terms, a transformer model learns by context and pattern recognition rather than strict rules. The robot learns how to do manual labor simply by analyzing thousands of hours of video showing humans working.
Just watching and learning.
Exactly. Furthermore, the Gen 3 features 22 degree of freedom robotic hands.
Which means it doesn't have those clunky metal pincer claws we usually associate with industrial robots.
Right. Its hands mimic the complex joints, tendons, and pressure sensitivity of a human hand. So if it encounters an irregularly shaped, squishy bag of dog food that it had literally never seen before,
it doesn't just crush it.
No, it doesn't freeze because the object isn't in its database. It dynamically figures out the center of gravity, applies the correct grip pressure, and picks it up safely, all while navigating around human coworkers.
So, what does this all mean? When you look at the economics of a machine that can adapt like that, the math becomes inevitable. You have a humanoid robot that costs under $25,000 to manufacture. It can work 22 hours a day. It only needs a 2-hour fast charge. It never gets a back injury. And it certainly doesn't require health insurance or a pension.
And this specific deployment brings the debate over universal basic income, UBI, out of the realm of, you know, Silicon Valley thought experiments and forces it into immediate socioeconomic policy discussions.
Right.
The report impartially outlines the two stark realities currently clashing here. On one hand, for e-commerce and logistics giants, the return on investment is practically undeniable. The efficiency and cost savings are astronomical.
But on the other hand,
massive alarm bells are ringing for labor unions and workers globally, because if routine mass manual labor becomes economically obsolete overnight, modern socioeconomic structures will require a fundamental redesign.
Which is why various governments are now positioning UBI as a potential primary lifeline to prevent the collapse of consumer-based economies. It really feels like every single physical and digital boundary is being crossed at once right now. Machines are replacing our physical screens. They are hallucinating our entertainment. They're intercepting our exact motor intentions directly from our cortex. And now they are physically performing our manual labor.
It's a lot to take in.
It begs the question, honestly. Is there any facet of the human experience left that isn't being scanned, quantified, and digitized?
Well, the European Parliament recently asked that exact question, and they delivered a very forceful legal answer.
Oh, the AI Act.
Yes. The final section of the Tekin report highlights the enforcement of the strictest clause within the EU AI Act, an absolute sweeping ban on emotion recognition AI across workplaces, schools, and public spaces in all EU member states.
And when you actually dig into the mechanics of what this emotion AI was doing out in the wild, it is incredibly creepy. We aren't just talking about basic facial recognition used to, like, unlock your smartphone.
Not at all.
Ad tech companies were using advanced computer vision networks to scan microscopic data points on your face while you were simply walking down the street or looking at a digital billboard. They were tracking real-time pupil dilation. They were categorizing fleeting micro-expressions.
They were even utilizing a technology called RPPG.
Right. Remote photoplethysmography. Which, I know, it sounds really complicated, but basically, every time your heart beats, your skin flushes with a microscopic variation in color.
Right.
It's totally invisible to the naked eye, but high-definition cameras can see it. These ad tech companies were using RPPG to calculate your actual real-time heart rate from a distance.
And all of these biometric inputs were combined to determine your exact psychological state in real time.
Because they wanted to know the why behind your attention. Did looking at that specific advertisement make you anxious? Did it elevate your heart rate with excitement? Were you fatigued? They harvested that organic biometric psychological data and fed it right back into predictive algorithms to manipulate consumer behavior more effectively.
And the EU has fundamentally decided that the internal human mind is a protected sanctuary. Under this new enforcement, any corporation caught deploying these emotional scanning systems without explicit, heavily regulated medical consent faces catastrophic penalties.
How big are the fines?
Fines of up to 7% of their total global annual revenue.
Wow.
Yeah, this is a lethal blow to pervasive targeted advertising ecosystems in that region. But what the report notes as truly significant is the geopolitical fracture this creates regarding how humanity actually interacts with technology.
The world is essentially splitting into two distinct philosophies of data.
Precisely. The report observes this expansion-driven pull primarily across the U.S. and parts of Asia, which largely operates on the premise that human biometric and psychological reactions are vital, harvestable data. They view this data as the necessary fuel to refine and improve AI algorithms.
Right, feed the machine.
Exactly. But opposed to that, you have the human-centric pull in Europe, which has drawn a hard line in the sand. They view this level of granular emotional scanning as a fundamental breach of organic privacy, a boundary that must be actively defended against intelligent silicon.
It really is a battle for the last frontiers of the human mind. So, when we pull all of these sources together, everything inside the Take In Morning report, the overarching takeaway is that the era of gadgets is definitively over.
Completely.
We aren't just using digital tools anymore. We are in the age of convergence. The technology is integrating directly into our vision, our physical environments, our nervous systems, and our manual workspaces.
And for you listening, navigating this convergence requires a proactive shift in perspective. According to the report, the most valuable currency in this new reality isn't coding or manual dexterity. It is what they call adaptability capacity.
I love that term.
It's vital. The challenge for all of us is to critically examine our own skills and industries. How will you adapt when traditional 3D modeling, typing on mechanical keyboards, and routine physical labor are no longer the primary ways value is generated?
It's a massive shift to process. But I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over today, building purely on the dots we've just connected.
Let's hear it.
We know that Sora 3.0 can hallucinate a highly realistic interactive digital reality in 5 seconds.
Right.
And we know that the Neuralink N1 chip can interface directly with the human motor cortex, decoding signals in under 10 milliseconds.
Yes.
So what happens when we inevitably connect them together?
Oh, wow.
What happens when a probabilistic neural network generates a reality and instead of projecting it onto a screen or even a pair of smart glasses, it feeds that reality directly into your brain, bypassing your physical eyes and optical nerves entirely.
Straight to the visual cortex.
Exactly. Are we just a few hardware updates away from synthesizing a reality that is completely indistinguishable from the organic one? If the glass window between us and the digital world is shattering, what happens when we can't even tell which side of the glass we're standing on?
That really is the ultimate defining question of the convergence.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Stay curious, keep adapting, and always keep questioning the world around you. We'll catch you next time.